Hey, everybody. This is Dr. Adam Rodman, and along with Shreya, I co-direct the iMed Initiative, that's the Innovations in Media and Education Delivery, at Beth Israel. I'm also the director of AI programs at our research center, and I lead the task force for the integration of AI into the Harvard Medical School curriculum.
And before we dive into today's episode, we have some exciting news to share.
That's right. The iMed conference is back. If you are passionate about technology, medical education, and what all of these exciting changes mean for the future of our field, boy, do we have a conference for you, the Conference on Digital Education and Artificial Intelligence.
Yeah, so we're going to have some really great panels. We're going to get into the weeds of how to get paid for what you love to do. How can you use AI to optimize your work-life balance? It's going to happen virtually on January 10th, Digital Education and Artificial Intelligence Conference.
You know, Shreya, what I've always, well, biased here, but what I love about our conferences is even though they're online, they're super hands-on. And we have integrated so many cool hands-on activities into our conference. Like, we're going to have a prompt-a-thon this year. We're going to get people learn how we can make large language models work for you as a busy medical educator.
Or even just like some of the administrative tasks we have to do day-to-day. Like, I mean, I hope someone's figured out how to use ChatGPT to like fill all the credentialing paperwork we have to do like every few years. That would be really helpful.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that is the goal of our conference. It is practical. It is not one of these, what is going to happen 5 to 10 years from now? It is what can you as an educator be doing to make your life easier and you a better teacher today? You're not going to want to miss Digital Education and Artificial Intelligence. Follow the link in our show notes, fill out the registration, and we will see you on January 10th.
Welcome to the Core AM Thigh Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. Today, we're talking all things parenteral nutrition. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by
Dr. Hita Mehta, an internist at UT Southwestern.
Dr. Margaret Lee, a pulmonary critical care fellow at the combined Harvard-MGH-BIDMC program. In this episode, we'll be discussing pearls related to total parenteral nutrition, aka TPN, and peripheral parenteral nutrition, aka PPN.
Test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions.
Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, Basics of Parenteral Nutrition. What makes up parenteral nutrition?
Pearl 2, Indications and Contraindications. When should I order and not order TPN and PPN?
Pearl 3, Complication of Parenteral Nutrition. What are things to watch out for when our patients are on parenteral nutrition?
Pearl 4, Parenteral Nutrition Myths. What should patients know before they start TPN?
Pearl 5, Recap on Tube Feeds. How do we determine the amount of free water to give our patients on tube feeds?
Guys, for me, parenteral nutrition, TPN, PPN, is something I just don't know a lot about. You know, oftentimes what happens is I'll get a page from nutrition. I just enter in whatever orders they recommend, don't think twice. But what exactly is in TPN and what is it really?
Yeah, Shreya, let's get into that. To break it down, we talked to Dr. Maria Romanova, who is a hospitalist at the Los Angeles VA Medical Center and on the nutrition support team there.
Ah, TPN. I love my TPN. So what does TPN consist of? Total parenteral nutrition delivers all macronutrients and micronutrients that body needs to sustain itself. Specifically, it has 10, 20, or 5% solution of dextrose. It has a mixture of essential and non-essential amino acids derived from whey protein. And it has triglycerides derived from soybean oil. In addition to it, we add all multivitamins and some micro elements like manganese and magnesium to it. That's pretty much it. Sometimes insulin is added to the mixture of parenteral nutrition.
So that's a general gist, but every day each component of TPN can be personalized to our patients' labs and their needs. So the amount of amino acids, fats, dextrose, and things like vitamins, minerals, electrolytes can change daily.
So all those ingredients are why both the nutrition team and the pharmacy team are so involved in preparing parenteral nutrition for patients.
So I guess now that we know a little bit about what's in TPN, how is TPN different from PPN?
Well, one thing right off the bat is that TPN and PPN are administered via different types of access. With TPN, a patient would need central access, while PPN can be given through the peripheral IV.
You need a central line or a PEEK line to deliver a hypersmolar formulation. But this is based on dextrose 20 or 10%. If patient does not have a central access, you can deliver nutrition through a peripheral vein as long as it's not that hypersmolar. For this, you dilute it in 5% dextrose. That's the only difference between CPN and PPN, central or parenteral. So how do we use each, right? Peripheral parenteral nutrition is less calorie dense, and it requires to be diluted in a larger amount of water, so to say. And so it's not really good to the patient to be receiving such a large volume of intravenous fluids for a long period of time.
Oh, so TPN and PPN are the same exact thing, but there's a difference in the access and the osmolarity based on how much dextrose it's diluted in.
And since PPN is often low osmolarity, the formulas are lower in calories. So with PPN, you need more volume in order to give you the same amount of calories you'd get with TPN.
And that makes TPN a little better for those people who need less volume, specifically those with heart failure or renal failure.
Actually, to operationalize that in real life, I'm curious how much volume difference are we talking about here between how much volume we give with TPN or PPN in a day?
I asked one of our local ICU pharmacists, Mirnaz Sadrullah-Shrafi. She was saying that TPN is typically 1 liter, maybe up to 2 liter if you add in extra lipids in a 24-hour period, while PPN is typically 2 liters or even more.
Okay, so it sounds like with TPN, maybe we're saving a patient 1 liter of fluid if possible in a day. So I guess if a patient does have central access, then maybe just reach for that TPN. I guess that also then makes me curious, what are the times that we should then reach for PPN?
And it's indicated for short periods, really up to 2 weeks. We usually start it when patient cannot have a central line placed, or if we don't anticipate that need for parenteral nutrition will be longer than a week or 10 days. So as I mentioned, it's a smaller solution, and it doesn't require central vascular access.
So PPN is typically given for shorter periods of time, or if we're not able to get central access.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, this may be a good place to recap. Parenteral nutrition, TPN, PPN, is basically the same thing in that it delivers all the micro and macronutrients a patient may need.
And then for the two types of parenteral nutrition that we have, the main difference between TPN and PPN are the components, specifically the concentration of the dextrose. PPN has a lower osmolarity in order to be safe for peripheral administration through the vein. And with PPN, in general, we're delivering more volume in order to get the same number of calories.
Okay, so now that we know what's in TPN and PPN, let's go over the indications and then the contraindications.
So there are two specific patient populations that need parenteral nutrition, those who only need it for a short period of time and those who need it for a prolonged period.
And Dr. Amelie Theron, a GI attending at BIDMC with an interest in clinical GI nutrition, told us about the typical patients she sees on short-term parenteral nutrition.
For the short term, if you have a patient that is very, very, very malnourished, that needs a surgery, that needs cancer therapy, sometimes you would get to a better nutritional state by doing TPN rather than to start 2 feeds. And then it's going to take longer, especially if they have severe Crohn's disease and they are kind of like obstructed or if they have lots of pain.
So short-term use of parenteral nutrition, it's going to be mainly patients post-surgery or those with a structural issue like Crohn's flare that will likely resolve. But what about our patients who need TPN more long-term? What are the indications for those?
Well, it's typically for patients who have GI tracts that don't work properly.
It's either because you do not have enough absorption capacity, either because you got several resection because of like ischemia, Crohn's, children that are born with necrotizing enterocolitis. So if your volume of normal villi that are absorbing, or if you have a severe enteropathy, celiac disease, graft versus host, until that gets fixed, you need to have IV support. So the length of the intestine, if the person has less than 100 centimeters of small bowel, or if there is severe villus atrophy.
Yes, often patients with villus atrophy or short bowel syndrome really need TPN for the long term. But just a reminder, short bowel syndrome occurs in patients with less than 200 centimeters of small bowel.
One other thing I thought was cool is the discovery of GLP-2s. Not to be confused with GLP-1s, which are used for diabetes and really well known for weight loss as well. GLP-2 agonists instead, like Gattex, increase villi and help improve absorption for patients with short gut syndrome, allowing some people to be even weaned off of TPN.
Whoa, move over GLP-1s. Here comes the GLP-2s.
That is really interesting. I honestly haven't had a patient on Gattex, but we'll look out for like, and what an interesting mechanism to actually increase villi. While we're talking about indications, are there any other long-term indications for TPN?
And then is it moving? Because yes, we have gastroparesis that we can bypass with a J-tube, but there are some people with scleroderma or severe neuromyopathic disorders that things are just not moving. So if they are getting tube feeds or food into their intestine, it will just sit there, bloat them, ferment with the bacteria, and it will not be digested in a good way.
Okay, so to recap, when we see a patient on long-term TPN, we should ask ourselves two questions. One, is the GI tract able to adequately absorb nutrients, whether it's because of the villi or the length of the gut? And two, is that GI tract able to move? And if the answer is no, then parenteral nutrition is likely indicated long-term unless something changes.
Okay, so now we know who gets TPN, but who shouldn't get TPN?
My first contraindication for TPN is if the gut is working, you gotta use it. So kind of going back to the tube feeding, right, is that if it's working, we are not going to bypass that. We got to keep it working. We're trying to prevent the atrophy, right? We're only going to use TPN if their gut is not working.
That's Cindy Huang, a dietitian from Houston, Texas. It might seem really obvious, especially after our tube feeds episode, but I love emphasizing the point that if someone has a functional gut, it needs to be used.
Yeah, Margaret, you do love that point. If the gut works, got to use it. I think for me, my favorite teaching from that episode is, you know, counseling patients that if you don't use the gut, you can have villus atrophy within days.
Yeah, I was really surprised how quickly it could come on. To me, the villi are like skills that need to be practiced. Otherwise, we'll lose the ability.
Yeah, just like so many things in life. Too real. All right. What are other contraindications to parenteral nutrition?
Infected line, a fungemia, it's better for the first 24 hours not to do any parenteral nutrition. The candida, they love the lipid and the nutrients, so it's good to give a break for the first 24 hours.
So line infections like bacteremia, typically Staph aureus, or fungemia should give us a pause.
Yeah, treatment often includes removing the line or something called lock therapy. Lock therapy is where a high concentration of IV antibiotics is instilled in the line. This helps to kill the bacteria that produce biofilms.
Thank you so much for going over that. I can't tell you how many times I've ordered lock therapy, but didn't really understand. It was just high concentrations of that antibiotic within the line to quote unquote be locked in there for a little bit and fight those biofilms.
And finally, we have a few relative contraindications to parenteral nutrition, which Dr. Romanova refers to as PN.
Those include uncontrolled hyperglycemia. Then we put patients on insulin drip. We get the sugars to under 300, and then we can start. Another situation where we use caution with use of PN is fluid overload state, like decompensated heart failure or multi-organ failure, where giving them too much fluid may cause harm. Those patients should be stabilized and diuresed before PN is started.
One last contraindication is the presence of severe electrolyte abnormalities, which should be corrected before starting parenteral nutrition, especially if the patient's at risk for refeeding.
Exactly. So let's summarize this pearl. In terms of indications for parenteral nutrition, in the short term, it's mostly going to be patients who are post-op or with structural issue like Crohn's flare that needs aggressive nutritional support in the short term. Long-term, it's going to be patients whose gut is not moving as well or can't absorb as well, whether it's a significant portion of the villi is affected or the length of the gut isn't as optimal.
Okay, and now let's recap the relative contraindications that may stop us from starting parenteral nutrition. These include sugars above 300, decompensated heart failure, and active bacteremia or fungemia.
And my favorite point, the hard contraindication to parenteral nutrition is, of course, if the gut is working, and in that case, to use PO options or tube feeds.
You do love that point. All right, and now onto the most relevant part for internists, and the part for me that was the most eye-opening, which is, what are the complications we should look out for once our patients are on TPN?
What I keep saying to patients, because we have some patients who are saying, oh, just put me on IV nutrition, that's going to get my gut at ease, give a break to my gut. But it's not natural to have parenteral nutrition. Like, it all goes directly to the liver. And then we see a lot of liver changes. Some people with long-term home TPN can even develop cirrhosis. All of those patients develop fatty liver disease after 6-8 weeks.
I can't believe that sugars and fats going through an IV goes directly to the liver and can trigger lipogenesis in less than 2 months.
Yeah, that was really surprising to me as well. So as internists, we really need to pay attention to how fats in a formulation may impact our patients' lipids as well as their LFTs.
There has been studies that have shown increased LDL, triglycerides, and decreased HDL. And so if someone is on this long-term, then that might be something to consider to change. There's another kind of lipoemulsion. So it kind of is more well-rounded of a fat for patients. You're trying to prevent the increase in the LDL, the triglycerides, by balancing out some of the components of the lipoemulsion. It's called SMOF lipid, and SMOF is just the letters S-M-O-F. It stands for soybean oil. The M is MCT oil. O is olive oil, and then F is fish oil.
Okay, so this is great to know that we have options for our patients on parenteral nutrition that can possibly prevent some of those, I don't know if they call this paneled, parenteral nutrition-associated liver disease. Kind of like a playoff of NAFLD and...
NAFLD.
Yes, NAFLD, exactly.
When you eat, there's a release of cholecystokinin, which makes the gallbladder contract and shoot bile into your GI tract. If all of your meals are from the parenteral nutrition and you're not using your GI tract, there would be some sludge developing in your gallbladder. So people are at risk of developing gallstones, acalculous cholecystitis, regular cholecystitis, if they are not eating at all.
So what we're saying here is that patients on TPN have sludge buildup in their gallbladder because they're just not using it. And this leads to a whole host of gallbladder badness.
Another complication that we're more cognizant of these days is overfeeding patients or giving them way too many calories, especially in the ICU.
In fact, too much calories for ICU patients that are ventilated, it can cause hypercapnia, and then their ventilation requirement change because they are suddenly burning more calories and producing more CO2. If you have an ICU patient that is on propofol on top of the TPN, these are two sources of lipid and that can contribute to increased triglyceridemia.
Therefore, the combo of propofol and parenteral nutrition is something to be aware of. It's pretty crazy how calorie consumption can be related to CO2 production.
Yeah, wild. There's so much ICU medicine that I've forgotten over the years, and interesting to think that this could maybe even lead to hypercapnia in some people. For me, guys, at least on the floor, is something that I've been seeing more in my day-to-day, more frequently, is a bunch of patients who have functional bowel syndrome, and they often ask for parenteral nutrition. And unfortunately, I don't feel like I have a good spiel on the risks and benefits of TPN for these patients.
Unfortunately, we see lots of people with visceral hypersensitivity, IBS, that have, in fact, a GI tract that is still working in the terms of motility absorption. And then they are inpatient and they are refusing the other options for enteral feeding and everything. And I explained how you need to have food in your intestine for the intestine to keep working. You need to have amino acids like glutamine to feed your intestine. Otherwise, there's going to be bacterial overgrowth. There's going to be more intestinal permeability. And then the person is just going to be super bloated and super uncomfortable as soon as they start eating again. And then it will just be a bad vicious cycle with their visceral hypersensitivity.
Okay, this is so helpful to paint a picture for patients that without using the gut, bacteria can actually overgrow. There's more intestinal permeability with that. And so if the patient does eat even a little bit for just some pleasure, that is not going to be very pretty and can kick off a vicious cycle.
And yes, and when you restart eating, your intestine is very confused to suddenly have that load of osmolarity of that food bolus that comes down, and those bacteria will start fermenting, and it will just worsen the bloating and the pain of the person. And if you stop eating, some of the bad fermenting inflammatory bacteria will win over the war against the good bacteria. And that will contribute to have more intestinal permeability, your intestine lacking that glutamine, that amino acid that I was saying, will be the enterocytes will kind of like start dying a little bit.
So avoiding feeds in a patient with a functioning GI tract can actually worsen hypersensitivity and cause bad bacteria to grow, which then causes enterocytes to die and actually worsen bloating and pain.
Oh man, maybe this would be a good place to recap the complications of parenteral nutrition. There are the risks that TPN goes straight to the liver and can cause fatty liver disease and gallstone blockages.
In the ICU, we should be mindful of a patient's total calories, especially if they're on both propofol and TPN.
And then maybe the most important thing for patients to hear is that if they do take anything orally, it can actually worsen some of their bowel symptoms from bacterial overgrowth.
So guys, this is a good place to pause and quickly go over some common misconceptions or myths on parenteral nutrition.
I have a few people that are coming back to me saying that they have diarrhea since they started the TPN. And I have to explain that it doesn't go at all into the GI tract. So it's not the cause of their diarrhea.
So the teaching here is that TPN goes through the IV directly to the liver, through the bloodstream, and it totally bypasses the GI tract. So parenteral nutrition shouldn't cause diarrhea.
Wait a minute. So how are these patients having a bowel movement if the parenteral nutrition doesn't even enter the GI tract?
Technically, if you're not eating, you will still have some cells shaving out of your colon, of your small intestine. There's still the cell turnover, the bacteria. So there's still some form of mucousy stools that are happening.
The cell turnover in the gut makes a lot of sense. I remember seeing patients who were NPO for days and they still have bowel movements.
Yeah, so true. I guess another thing that this brings up is, I know a good diarrhea history is a whole loaded topic, but I wonder if the misconception about TPN causing diarrhea comes from people kind of calling those mucus loose stools like quote unquote diarrhea.
Yeah, that reminds me of the tube feeds episode where the tube feeds does not itself cause diarrhea, but it's actually the gut atrophy.
Okay, so the second misconception is the thought that pure water will be helpful for all patients when they're dehydrated. But actually, patients with severe enteropathy require a solute like sugar to help absorb water from the gut.
When you have a severe enteropathy, to have pure water, it will not help you. The water to be fully absorbed by your intestine needs sodium, needs sugar. So our patient with short bowel syndrome, with severe enteropathy, we tell them to avoid drinking water. They have to drink orange juice that is a bit diluted.
So the dietitians that reviewed this episode did note that the Gatorade that's recommended is usually diluted to lower the sugar content with also like half a teaspoon of salt. It's something maybe a little bit more closer to what we would give for oral rehydration solution. I think the big picture takeaway though is if a patient does have severe enteropathy and they're going to take in something orally for hydration, they do need some solute to go with it.
Okay, last thing for me is when should we consult or involve GI when starting a patient on TPN? I know that our GI consult list is always so long, and I typically don't want to bother them.
I would say, yeah, that one of the misconceptions is that, oh, okay, we can give to a functional GI patient TPN, and that's going to be fine, and the GI doctor can wean this off as an outpatient. This is one problem that sometimes we are facing, and it's better to always involve us if, as an inpatient, you have a patient without like a structural malabsorption or full motility disorder that you want to start on TPN, because after that, we are the ones trying to wean the patient down and then the patient doesn't want to stop.
I imagine it's not fun on the GI end of things when they have to do the hard job of weaning TPN when they weren't even involved in the first place with thinking through other options or understanding symptoms or the pathology before initiation.
That's a great point. Maybe I shouldn't be so scared to consult GI.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's hospital dependent, like who's responsible for the weaning, but I agree. Maybe it's better to loop these people in on the earlier side. They do have a hard job sometimes.
Sometimes.
A lot of times.
All the time. So to summarize our section on myths and misconception, it's important to know that parenteral nutrition does not cause diarrhea, but patients will likely still have mucusy-like stools from cell turnover.
Yep. And then another one is that in severe enteropathy, the gut still needs some solute to fully absorb water orally. So reaching for some diluted Gatorade or some other oral hydration solution may be the way to go. And then last thing is that it's better to involve GI or whoever's responsible in your hospital for weaning before starting patients on TPN.
And that concludes our discussion on parenteral nutrition. But before we go, Shreya, you always mention the importance of spaced repetition.
I am a huge nerd around it. I am not even ashamed of it. And so, of course, now that you bring it up, I say, why don't we use this as headspace to cement some things from our tube feeds episode and maybe even add on to it.
One thing that I took away was learning that the number behind a tube feed formula indicates the kilocalories per milliliter. So if you see a 1.5 or 2.0 at the end of a tube feed name, you know it's a more concentrated formula, which is good for patients if we want to give them less volume.
Yeah, I didn't understand those numbers either, and it's been such an aha since the episode, especially since I feel like we're always thinking about volume status in our patients, right? Whether it's avoiding the complications of dehydration and also the other side of things where we don't want them to be overloaded.
Yeah, and this reminds me of another knowledge gap, particularly with free water flushes. When I order tube feeds, there's typically a default for the volume and frequency of free water flushes.
Yeah, same. And I just feel like going with whatever generic default our EMR has for free water flushes is probably not right. And now that I think about it more, I'm curious, how can we tailor how much free water flushes a patient needs?
So we sat down with registered dietitians Shayna Shape and Danielle Horn, who work at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, to help us clear up all this.
So there are several different equations for estimating fluid needs. Some common ones would be energy-based equations. So like you can think of that as how many milliliters of free water they might need based on their calorie needs. Another A common method is more of a weight-based equation. So common weight-based equations would be using between 25 and 35 milliliters per kilogram of body weight.
So the 25 milliliters per kilogram is more for older patients or patients who need fluid restriction. 35 mils per kilogram is more for the younger patients.
Yeah, and just to play it out, say we had a patient who was 75 kilograms, and depending on if you're using the 25 mls per kg or 35 mls per kg, a 75 kilogram patient would either need 1.8 liters of water a day or 2.6 liters of water a day. But that's kind of crazy when you think about the default of, say, 50 mls of free water flushes, Q6 hours. That's only like 200 mls a day.
Yeah, but I'm wondering how much fluid is in the actual tube feeds itself. And then maybe the free water flushes are just a supplement.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe I'm jumping too far ahead.
If you're taking into account tube feeding volume, each tube feeding volume has a different percentage of free water. So usually 1.5 formulas are around 76%, which is typically the caloric density that we use if patients are on a lower, like a 1.0 calorie per milliliter formula. It could be, I think, like 84% free water.
So the percentage of free water in tube feeds can range anywhere from 70 to 84%, depending on if the tube feeds are the more concentrated 2.0 version, then you're thinking maybe it's 70%, or the less dense 1.0 version.
So if someone's getting 2 liters of tube feeds in a day that have around 75% free water, then they're already getting 1.5 liters in a day of free water just from the tube feeds itself.
Okay. So if we go back to our 75 kilogram patient who needs anywhere from 1.8 liters to 2.6 liters in terms of baseline hydration needs, and we now know, thanks to you, Hina, you know, their daily tube feeds is giving them 1.5 liters of free water, then yeah, if we're adding 200 milliliters of free water flushes, say, you know, divided 50 mls Q6 hours, maybe it's like barely meeting that minimum requirement, but somewhat close enough.
Yeah, so you don't have to feel so guilty, Shara, but after doing this math, I would maybe go up on the flush volume or frequency to prevent dehydration.
And one thing to make you feel better is that most of our patients on tube feeds are likely also receiving IV medications, which may give a patient additional fluid intake that we don't really account for.
All these are great points. So to recap, what I'm taking away is that baseline hydration requirements for patients, we can start with a weight-based approach, 25 to 35 mls per kilogram per day. And then once we get that number, we can subtract the free water that we get from the tube feeds, which is going to be anywhere from 70 to 84% of that total liter that they're getting from their tube feeds. And then also we can subtract any extra fluids they might be getting from medications. And then whatever number we have left over is going to be the extra amount of free water we want to supplement with free water flushes.
And that's a wrap for our episode on TPN and PPN.
If you found this episode helpful, please share with your team and colleagues and give it a rating on whatever podcast app you use.
And if you want to learn more, check out the Core IM website and YouTube channel for additional resources.
Yeah, we'll link some of the original clips from the interview with Dr. Amelie Therrien. It was just so eye-opening. Thank you so much to our reviewers, dietitians Chelsea Ferlin and Juliette Schulberg for reviewing this episode. Thank you to Dr. Bhatia for the audio editing. And as always, opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Take care.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get a juicy frozen grade A Kroger turkey for 49 cents a pound, limit one with a $25 additional purchase with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.